Welcome to the MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me is James. We are back.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. No, Merry Christmas. Happy holiday. Happy New Year.
Yeah, thank you for running through all the holidays in quick succession. Yeah, we're back. I don't know what we last talked about, but I think it was good. Check out the MacGuffinMen.com to get that. To get our most recent podcast, we had a good fall. And I think pretty much the only movie from 2014 that we haven't done a podcast on that we will end up doing is Inherent Vice. So that will be coming at some point. Yeah. But this week is decidedly not a 2014 topic. but yeah, we'll get to the theme song and then we'll start talking about some Mike Nichols.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Rest in peace, eh?
Yeah. I've already mentioned his name more times on this podcast than we did on our entire graduate podcast, by the way.
Yeah. So this movie is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yes. No, I just watched Liz and Dick, the Lifetime movie starring Lindsay Lohan and whoever played Dick in that movie.
And yeah, we should point out it was directed by Mike Nichols, who we'll talk about. And
it's his directorial debut, even.
It is, yeah. Which we will talk about that as well, because mm-hmm. It was quite a role. Like in a lot of ways, this movie was a big roll of the dice for Warner Brothers. But mm-hmm. We'll get to that. But yes, we did do a graduate podcast a while ago. And
three full years, I believe. Or maybe.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it must be 3 years.
So if you want to hear Alex say really nice things about a movie, you can go back and listen to that. In the meantime, director Mike Nichols died. So we thought we might do, I'm on a bit of a classic movie kick anyway. And we, didn't want to pass up an opportunity to give Mike Nichols some love and note his passing in the interim. So,
yeah, I mean, we waited 2 months to do it, but
yes,
we never said we weren't lazy.
Right. Yeah. So as I said, we're talking about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf today. Mm-hmm. 1966, directed by Mike Nichols, as you said, in his directorial debut. He had a lot of experience in theater, but this was kind of his trip to Hollywood and his exposure to the filmmaking system. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I like Mike Nichols even more researching him for this movie.
Yeah.
I found out he was like in a very early influential improv troupe that turned into Second City.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and yeah. If you read about Mike Nichols, you would love Mike Nichols.
Everything I find out about him, I like him even more.
But, yeah, he adapted Catch-22, and that he did about as well as you can do with Catch-22 if you're adapting it. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't, actually.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, I really love the book, but you know that. But yeah, so as I said, this was Mike Nichols had a lot of experience in theater. This was originally a play written by Edward Albee. I think it came out in like 1962. It premiered, and you know, we kind of touched on the fact that making this movie for Warner Brothers was a bit of a gamble. And I mean, it seems odd thinking of it now, but watching this movie. There is a lot of what would be at the time pretty like subversive, touchy subjects and language.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, it's a movie about marriage made in 1966 that I was fascinated by, you know, and for reasons outside of history. So, like, I didn't think about all those things when I was watching it.
What did you know about this?
I knew the title. I thought I knew Liz Taylor was in it, and I ended up being right about that. And that's pretty much the end of it.
Yeah, plot-wise, I had really no idea. But yeah. So I continue.
Yeah, and so when I was just reading about it after having watched it, I was just like, oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense. You know, like that a movie about a relationship in 1966 that is it's still interesting in 2015 when you're watching it, would probably be kind of controversial, you know, at the time, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, it does seem like, I don't know, it seems like a very bizarre thing to get up in arms about, but that's because it was almost 50 years ago, you know? And things were different then. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, it as a play, it even kind of caught some people off guard. You know, people going to, you know, classy, stuffy people going to Broadway expecting a certain thing. I think this the story is that this threw them for a bit of a loop. Yeah. And again, the language now seems pretty tame, but Hump the Hostess, Great Nipples, Screw You, which was wildly inappropriate, apparently. Mm. Yeah, so the language was one thing that made this a very kind of touchy subject. And then, you know, and that was still in the play. And then when it came to make this play into a movie, they kind of rolled the dice as a studio just to even take on this subject matter. But then, you know, we mentioned Liz Taylor, who at the time would be considered, you know, one of the most beautiful women in the world. Mm-hmm. They kind of frumped her up, made her look like, you know, in her 50s. She gained 30 pounds for the role.
Still looks great, though. Like, they didn't.
Oh, no.
They tried their hardest, but
it still isn't
didn't bad. Totally work.
And again, she also tries to seduce someone during this. Well, I guess successfully seduces someone in this movie. So, you know, she does dress and try to play up the sex appeal at certain times in this mm-hmm. movie. So you have that. But even just, you know, taking an alpha like Richard Burton and having him play kind of a weak-willed associate professor. You know, we touched on the bad language, and another thing we mentioned already, but I think, like, to give this movie to a first-time director with these stars after it was such a hit on Broadway, it really was a big risk. And I mean, this mm-hmm. movie cost $7.5 million, which is, you know, not a small amount of money, especially at the time. Mm-hmm. So it really was like a really big gamble by the studio, and one that I feel worked out very well.
Yeah, exactly. I like this movie a lot.
I was wondering how you'd feel about it.
Oh, big fan. I generally support the whole transition between a play coming to a movie. I always find that kind of interesting. Because I think it kind of amplifies the filmmaking choices that you make, because you get to make fewer of them. Yeah. And I think that that's always interesting. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought Liz Taylor was great. I really enjoyed her. I really enjoyed Richard Burton as well. And it was just, I don't know, I thought it was really interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kind of for what we were discussing, kind of just the really frank look at relationships, and
yeah,
like that's what you liked about it?
Yeah, kind of. And that it's really this slow sort of peeling away of all of these things. And, you know, probably in the first 20 minutes or something, there's something that makes me think that, oh, they don't want to talk about their kid because their kid is dead or something. And then it gets way weirder than that. Yeah. It's a very bizarre movie, and George and Martha are incredibly bizarre people. But so somehow in that bizarreness, they end up, I don't know, saying something interesting about something that most people can deal with, you know, or can understand, right? Being marriage.
Yeah, and just relationships. And I think, yeah. You know, It's really weird watching them, because at the start of the movie, it just seems, you know, they've just come home from the party. They're fighting. She's trying to figure out a line from a movie, and it's just excruciating.
I love that scene. I thought that was so interesting.
It's a fine scene. It's just, yeah. You know, as a husband, I think that might be difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, and then you kind of see them fighting, and then it just looks like a very kind of unhappy marriage. They're not really on the same page. They seem to be very different people. And then they have a really, really sweet part up in their bedroom when they're just in bed goofing around, and it's just a few minutes. And, you know, and this comes from adapting a play into a movie, but, you know, you're spending a long time with just a few people, and you really get to see their personalities. And it's, you know, it's very character driven. There's very little action in this movie. Mm-hmm. And so you know, you kind of really do get to know these characters really well. And then for a while, it's just, you know, that couple is all we really see in them communicating. And so it goes from looking like a pretty bad marriage to, you know, you see glimpses of how they fell in love in the first place, maybe what it is that keeps them together. And then, you know, soon they're back at each other's throats. And then you see them being rude to each other, and then when the new couple comes over, you see them being rude to them, and then taking turns, and like all this cross-directional fighting and deception and stuff. Like, it's it's, I don't know, man. It's a lot of kind of like a domestic relationship. You just see, you know, just so many sides of a relationship really quickly. And, you know, you see the good times, you see bad times really quickly. You see some things that, you know, they clearly know each other so well and kind of how to handle each other. And, you know, it's just a small, you know, few relationship scenes that I think are done really slowly and really well.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's important that we're able to see transitions, sometimes quick transitions, between these two people seemingly hating each other and really enjoying each other's company. I mean, the movie starts with Martha laughing as they're walking home. And pretty quickly, once they get home, they're kind of at each other's throats. And then after that, like you mentioned, they're just in bed giggling and having fun. And then he doesn't want to kiss her. And then that starts a new fight, you know? But the whole thing is that, you know, even with these, I think that these moments of annoyance and frustration are, they put up with them for those small moments, you know? And yeah, I do think that this movie does a really good job of getting that across, you know?
Yeah, and Edward
that's sort of like that range of moods that people go through.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, right away you just think, why are these people together? And then you know you see those little bits of how they get along, you know, how good things can be at a time. And Edward Albee, the man who wrote the play, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf, is known for having these kind of very honest looks at people in relationships. And you know, when you look very honestly at human interaction, it can often be very, very depressing. And, you know, this movie sometimes functions as not a warning, but kind of an example of how people don't want to be alone and kind of the things you do or say or put up with or completely fabricate in order to be with someone and to be to make them and yourself happy. And when those things aren't the same thing and you need to put your happiness in front of someone else, and yeah, it's all these kind of dark things that is everything but kind of puppy love. Like it's the years and years and the fights of things that happened in the past and all the, you know, all the things that you could do to annoy each other. And then the you know, there is an honest, very true connection between these two people. And you know, the end really seems to drive that home, but you get glimpses of it throughout.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, when Gone Girl came out, there was a lot of just people bringing up Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in their reviews. And you can kind of see why. You know, Gone Girl is just sort of David Fincher's version of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And it's this look at a marriage where you see the progression. You see why you think they got together. And in Gone Girl, you see a more extreme version of why they end up staying together. Yes. But
much more extreme everything in Gone Girl.
Well, yeah, exactly. Except, I think, probably potentially alcoholism. Performances. Yeah, alcoholism and performances. I don't think Rosamund Pike yells at all in Gone Girl.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, it makes sense now that I have seen the movie that was referenced in the reviews. You know, it makes sense.
Yeah, just all the damage they do to each other. And like it, what I mean, that couple did not know the night that they were going to be in for when they went over there after the party, that's for sure.
Yeah.
One thing that, and I think part of this is it coming from a play again, but I think part of it is just the time period for Hollywood being this, you know, mid-60s. A lot of the stuff does seem really stilted and melodramatic. Like there's a lot of chewing of the scenery and kind of the swelling music at the end and certain times throughout. But a ton of this movie is really subtle. Like,
yeah, oh yeah.
And, you know, I think that's something that gets kind of glossed over with movies of this period because some stuff is so big and so obvious and so hammy. But, you know, some of the major plot points are, you know, quiet little things whispered and then you kind of need to decode a little bit. Like Honey's fake pregnancy / maybe real pregnancy / abortion.
Yeah. Can we please call it a hysterical pregnancy? Because that's one of my favorite terms in the history of the English language.
So awful. No, but I mean, it's a huge point for that character. It's a pretty big point in the movie. And, you know, they really just don't hammer it home. Like it's really left. It's, you know, it's not the Godfather's handling of an abortion yeah. announcement at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I just want to get kind of your thoughts on the kind of dichotomy of things, you know, something coming from a play gets, you know, gets so big and so performative. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a lot of things in this movie just kind of play out really quietly sometimes. Well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I like that because it's a change, you know, and I enjoy writing what it has done well. And there's a lot of that in this film, you know, and I really there were a couple moments, like you said, where it's like, wait, I feel like I just kind of like missed something really important, but there wasn't the cue that I'm used to. And to sort of let me know that this was an important thing. And that was something that I really enjoyed. And I really enjoy watching a movie that I feel like thinks it's smart or that I can keep up with it, you know, that assumes it. Whereas most movies that you watch, they're making sure somebody's slightly dumber than you can follow it, you know. So you can kind of zone out a little bit every once in a while. Can't really do that in this movie. And I find that very respectable, you know. I love being treated like an intelligent adult, and this movie absolutely does that.
Yeah, no, the viewer gets a lot of credit here, and I was just looking, as I do when I research movies, at the IMDb boards to see kind of the how people feel about it generally.
Yeah, how are the boards doing back in 1966?
So here's your board update. Yeah. No, there's just tons of like, wait, did they actually have a kid? Like, what happened? Was there an abort? Like, there's just so many things that, yeah, if you're really not paying attention, like, huge, huge plot points can slip by you. And it's, yeah, it's nice to be treated that way as a viewer because it's more realistic. You can put more things in if you're not spelling everything out for everybody. Mm-hmm. It demands your attention, but it's worth it. And it confused a lot of people. I mean, this is not... you know, Inception or like something with a bunch, like a really crazy time travel, multi-layered, you know, sci-fi kind of movie. It's a relationship movie. It's two couples, you know, one couple that seems to have been together for a few decades, one that's kind of just starting out and the differences. And, you know, it was nice to see that other couple kind of having the seeds of this kind of dysfunctional relationship developing.
Oh yeah, there's so much pairing of the two couples, like, so they're supposed to be seen as a reflection of each other.
Yeah, they all like pair off, like, you know, you kind of get every combination of everyone throughout the movie, and you see how everyone interacts with everybody.
Yeah, and maybe like one of the least subtle moments in this movie is where George refers to Honey as Martha or vice versa, you know, and that happens a couple times, and but it's still like that's something that I, you know, unsurprisingly sniped very quickly. But yeah, that's one of the few things in this movie they lean harder on than they actually need to. It really helps the movie that, you know, that it's just kind of a younger version of them. And that's how we're supposed to see it as well. And I really enjoy it.
Yeah, and I think at the beginning of the movie, we very much are supposed to be kind of in that young couple's shoes, Nick and Honey. Nick, who curiously goes unnamed the whole film. Mm-hmm. you kind of walk into this house as them, and you see this couple fighting, and they are, you know, clearly have all this dysfunctionality, and she's drinking all the time, and they're both being very disrespectful to each other, and
puts chicken bones back in the fridge.
Yeah, her whole chicken thing is weird. Puts a dirty plate in the drawer.
There's one close up of her eating chicken that I found very enjoyable. Like, it's just that's such a great shot for somebody to allow, like, a star as big as her to allow to exist in this movie.
Yeah, it's someone who is so much sex appeal, right? Like, yeah, but to get back, like, we're supposed to kind of see, I think we see ourselves as Nick and Honey for a bit and be like, oh, we're the normal people. These people are the crazy ones. And then, you know, it slowly gets revealed that, you know, there's deception and mistrust and all these other things in their relationship. And, you know, there's just seeds of it. And you can think like, oh, OK, well, you water that for 30 years. And, you know, this is what happens. Like, this is where you end up. And so it just kind of slowly builds up, and we kind of, I like that. I like that we kind of kind of see them at the beginning as kind of neutral, normal, good people who we kind of relate with as a viewer. And then that kind of slowly slips away from us. And then, you know, you're like, oh, well, maybe everyone's a bit messed up. And I think that's kind of that honest look at things that Edward Albee kind of gets credit for, of that kind of darkness seeping into the human relationship.
Yeah, for sure. And there is there's a real sort of like sense of mystery that exists throughout the movie because of the things we've talked about, the small movements of the plot. And I mean, despite the fact that these reveals are all happening quietly through dialogue, it's still sort of you're piecing together what's actually going on. And we really see that at the end with Nick sort of starting to piece together the story of their son. And yeah, and I like that a lot. There was a movie that came out about a year or two ago called The Past with Bérénice Bejaud, which was kind of similar in that way. It was less of a play, but it seemed like every scene you were learning a new thing about these characters, which changed everything else that you knew previously. And that's exactly what happens in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you know? And I find that really interesting, you know? Because not a lot physically changes, but everything in this movie changes.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned you kind of know there's something wrong when the kid gets mentioned and not seen, and you don't really see any of his stuff around. Mm-hmm. He also mentions her. Martha's never been pregnant, kind of just in passing.
Yeah, yeah.
A bit of a hole in your story.
Test tube baby. Those existed in 1966, right?
Sure. 1950, right? Yeah. 16 years old. And as you said, like things just kind of get slowly revealed. You have the kid, his novel, that story about the kid who killed both of his parents by accident. Mm-hmm. You know, all these things get slowly revealed and just illuminate these people as people deceiving themselves and deceiving each other, and life just not being, you know, what they thought it is, or even what they're telling themselves it still is, even when the truth is right in front of them.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier when he calls, he mistakes and calls Honey Martha.
Mm-hmm. When he's talking to Nick at the time.
Yeah. There's a ton of this kind of stuff throughout the movie, and mm-hmm. very broadly, this movie is just illusion versus reality. You know, there's tons of mistakes like, oh, that's my wife. Oh, I work in the biology department. You know, there's a million little kind of just back and forth of dialogue like that where a mistake is made. And sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's not. But there's just a misunderstanding or a misidentification. And everyone's talking about this world that doesn't actually exist. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a different name and you work in the wrong place and you grew up here. And, you know, there's all these kind of details that just get flipped really quickly back and forth. And, you know, we talked about with the pairing off of the couples and things like that. And, you know, it's funny at first. And sometimes you, it has a narrative function. You know, you see how, George isn't engaged in this conversation because he's not really hearing what Nick is saying. Mm-hmm. Or you hear these couples intentionally misquoting or making mistakes about what the other person has done or said as, you know, a way to try to upset them. And it's not till, you know, probably there's a third left in the movie that you really start to see that they are living huge lies as well. They're not just kind of saying these small things accidentally or with malice to hurt someone else, but they truly are like deceiving themselves on some major things. Mm-hmm. Nick and Honey and George and Martha. There's so much deception and self-deception in this movie. And it, as I said, that dialogue works in the beginning. And I love a lot of the dialogue in this movie. I think this movie has a ton of really good laughs.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Considering how dark and heavy it is.
Yeah.
Especially the first like two thirds, there's tons of really, really, really funny stuff.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff that's funny and depressing at the same time. Like, by all means, drink away. You'll need it as the years go on. You know.
Yeah.
And there's that line about regrets later on that George has that I can't totally remember. Nick says you're going to regret this. George says, no doubt, I regret everything, yeah. Which is so funny and profoundly sad.
So, so dark. Yeah, like even Wikipedia calls it a black comedy. But mm-hmm. Yeah, there is some humor like that. Yeah, like there's little just kind of quippy stuff, like show her where we keep the euphemism when talking about the bathroom.
I love that, yeah.
Oh, there's tons of good, like really quick, kind of snappy, funny jokes that you see a lot of from that time period. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like kind of the really big laughs are those black ones you're talking about. Like mm-hmm. just, it's a good joke. And it's a good joke that reveals something so deep and dark about these people.
Yeah, exactly. It's extra funny because you can't understand how somebody would be that honest with somebody else, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy.
One of the things I do enjoy about this movie is the, we touched on it a bit earlier, but George and Martha looking at Nick and Honey and kind of just seeing them as kind of more optimistic and, but George and Martha just sort of see themselves and, they see this more optimistic couple and they just want to be like, oh, it gets so much worse, you know? that's the thing I like the most about how they pair this younger and older couple together. And throughout the movie, you get sort of, you get the George and Martha learning that, you know, like Martha sort of seems to kind of value Nick for his youth, right? And then she finds out that, you know, their youth isn't necessarily perfect. He's still kind of, he's a flop in some areas, if you will. and same with the potential wisdom that George has by being older. Yeah, he's wiser, but he's also a much more terrible person, you know? And the effect that time has on these people, and also the romanticization of youth that maybe George and Martha are doing a little bit of. The young people have their own problems too. You know, it's not like youth, you know, being 28 really resets everything, right?
Yeah,
and there's a lot of that in this movie.
I love when he says he's 21. When George says Nick, he's 21 years old. Like they think of them as so young and so youthful. Like yeah. They're just the epitome of just becoming an adult, right? When
yeah.
Really, they've had this pregnancy thing. They've had the life. Like he has his master's. He's a professor. Like he has a life, but they just think of him as so little still.
Yeah, and they might not even be married if she didn't get pregnant. That seems to be the what's implied in the movie.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of that in the Nick and Honey relationship is sort of once we start to figure that out, a lot of things make sense, right?
Yeah, the Martha and George, the Martha and Nick stuff is so intense. Like mm-hmm. we don't get that on the other side of it. Like we don't have the George trying to seduce Honey or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Just when he's talking about his body and if it's still firm and like... I don't know, man. It's so uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, and Martha just mentions it to George very, like, when it's just the two of them at their house at the very beginning, like, when she's going to the washroom or whatever. He's like, he's young, he's fit. And okay. You know, it's just a weird thing to say to your husband.
I know. Sometimes every time I watch a movie like this, I'm like, is this because it's the 60s or is this actually really weird?
No, I think that one's really weird.
Yeah,
I think especially in the 60s that one's really weird.
I love like when telling a story of someone get punched into a huckleberry bush. Like, how 60s is that?
I know. And how 60s is how much goddamn liquor gets consumed in this movie.
Oh my god, let's talk about the booze in this. Okay, so
everybody drinks incredibly quickly in the 1960s.
So much.
Giant glasses of gin and bourbon get demolished in 30 seconds.
Like straight liquor. And they go driving. Like, you know, there's websites where they have kind of a drinking game for like any movie or TV show.
Yeah.
And there's always like 30 rules. Yeah. There's one rule for those who's general drinking game. There's one and one only. And drink whenever they drink and then die.
No. It's two rules, actually. It's kind of like a two-part rule. It's drink whenever they drink until you just start getting sad and then drink away your own sadness. That's the that's the Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf drinking game. The one thing I really like about the way the movie treats alcohol is that at the very beginning
that it's a medicine. You look pale. Perhaps some brandy.
Oh, did you injure your knee? Pour some brandy on it. The scene where George is sitting at the kitchen table and Martha's eating her chicken with such vigor. George mentions that he's tired. Yeah, exactly. George mentions that he's tired. It is 2 a.m. when this movie starts. And I think and also we know they've been at a party. Presumably they've been drinking all evening. Nick at one point says he started drinking at 9 p.m., you know, and they go till dawn in this movie. The thing I find really enjoyable about this movie is the way it treats sort of the acceleration of intimacy that comes with being tired and too drunk.
Oh, yeah. It's a very booze-fueled movie. Like,
yeah.
There's obviously problems, but this doesn't take place without 90 bottles of booze.
Yeah, exactly. But there is sort of also the element, like, it really compounds itself when you're also very tired and I don't know, when you're 4 drinks in at 10 p.m. or 4 drinks in at 4 a.m., you know, like you're getting more secrets out of this person at 4 a.m. Yeah. And I thought that was really sort of like, it's never really something that's discussed. It's just something that absolutely exists that runs throughout this movie that I found kind of interesting, because I couldn't think of a movie that really treated that as accurately as I feel like this movie does. Just because, again, as the movie progresses, we continue to learn more and more in a very progressive way, not unlike drinking progressively affects.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Your mood, yeah.
It fits right in.
I'm sorry? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
sorry. How do you feel about the visuals?
It's...
Because, you know, you said you have fewer choices to make and... You know, a play usually doesn't have those big action scenes. Like, it's, you know, it's quieter, it's slower, it's,
yeah,
you know, as you said, you can just, it's really, you make fewer decisions, but those can have a much greater impact.
Yeah. When I was watching this movie, I did not know what year it was released. And as I was watching it, I was like, I couldn't figure out for sure. I would have guessed before, but I couldn't figure out for sure if it was made before or after The Graduate, which I think says a lot about this film. Because it is still, like, the moments that are stylish are wonderful. Like, there's a really great shot when Nick and Martha are just kind of flirting and honey's and sitting watching all of this. It's all three of their faces framed and they're all kind of in focus. I don't even know how they did that. It seems very impressive on its own. Yeah. But it's Martha on the right and then Nick in the middle and then Honey further back in the left, just watching this, and she's being totally ignored while these two are talking. And that's like just this one small moment that's still really nice. And keeping on Honey listening into people, that shot of her as she's at the top of the stairs listening to Nick and George discuss her, I loved that. I thought that was a really,
like, 1 second and then she goes, like,
okay. Yeah, it was very and more subtle than I've seen moments like that done in other movies too. That was interesting. And I think the sequence leading into George getting that gun is amazing.
What do you think when that was going to happen?
I thought it must have been like a dream sequence or something, because at that point in the movie, it felt like this can't be a movie that where somebody gets murdered and then we're going to fill out the rest of this 2-hour, 10-minute runtime with, because it's very early on. It's probably at the 40-minute mark at the latest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I certainly was not anticipating an umbrella. I also wasn't anticipating murder, you know, or maybe fake murder, and that this was going to get a little weird.
Yeah, I really didn't know what to make of that, but I didn't think that Elizabeth Taylor is going to be killed at the 30-minute mark. So.
Yeah, exactly. But that sequence is really interesting because it's this, you get sort of this, I think there's a little bit of music that comes in as he's walking to get the umbrella gun.
It's all very slow and deliberate.
Yeah, exactly. And then, like, the other three people have been laughing in a wide shot together, and he's going to get this gun. He gets the gun. As he's coming back, you get these three in succession close-ups of Honey, Nick, and Martha all laughing, and they're all great shots, and they also kind of feel a little off-kilter because it really feels like George is fed up of being laughed at, and that's what's leading to this, which is what's happening. And and it's just this really great visual moment. And like I said about a filmmaker, especially in these types of movies, having to pick their spots, that sequence was, despite how brief it was I found really affecting.
And there are some things that, like, I made notes writing and then I look back on them and it's things that I thought I would criticize about a movie, but like when she's really when I guess it's when I think it's when George is pretty drunk near the end, or maybe Nick, but you know, it gets blurry, and then there's kind of like the stumbly camera when people are stumbling.
Yeah, there are a couple of point of view shots in this movie that are in soft focus to sort of show that. Yeah,
yeah, and there's that one of Martha crying that she's like it's as though her tears are blurring up the lens, and it's mm-hmm. it's a picture of her. It's not from her eyes, but you just look at her, and then it's kind of like blurring in and out, and she's really going through something. She's obviously crying a lot. And I think that can be done. I guess maybe it's just the surrounding. Like, I think that can be done in a really cheesy way that would upset me. But I think it's done really minimally, pretty subtly, and, you know, in the middle of what I consider to be a very good movie. So I think that that works for me.
Yeah, for sure. The last one you're talking about, I know what you're talking about. And I think I couldn't figure out a reason for that shot, like why it was in soft focus. I think there might be. That might have been just the best performance that she gave, and they just used the take anyway.
Okay.
It might have also been on purpose, and I'm just missing something. But that really felt like a moment where it's like, oh, they just got this really great moment, and so what if it's a bit out of focus? It's worth it, you know?
Yeah. I thought tears, but it's, you know, either way.
Tears does make sense, actually.
Yeah. And you mentioned something, you know, a lot of the kind of the visual choices and things being off kilter. We get some of those, like, is it the Dutch angle, those like crooked upward shots?
Oh yes,
get a few of those, and some kind of the kind of just like menacing low angle shots too that I thought, well,
and
dance cam.
Yeah, well, you can't dance like the wind and not have dance cam, right? the Dutch angle that you're discussing, my favorite use of it was in the bar when Liz Taylor takes to the drums, and that sequence is another one that I really enjoyed, that because it's sort of, I don't know, we're getting to this real deep hurt for George, and it really this movie a handful of times really speaks to the idea that the person that knows you the most can hurt you the most, or knows you the best can hurt you the most, and that scene is the perfect example of it, to the point that it ends with him choking her, and having Honey even scream violence twice in the background adds this really incredible feel of menace to it. And that was another sequence, like the umbrella gun sequence, that I found really intense, I guess.
It's, you know, what you said about the people who know you the best can hurt you the most. There's something just, especially that the discussion of that dance scene is what reminded me, but she's often so brazen about it. Like, it's not like really cold and calculating. Like, it's like, oh, it comes up in conversation and we're dancing and laughing. And remember that time you poured your heart and soul into a book and it didn't get published? Fuck you. Like, it's all so casual. It's not like she says it really cold and icily looking into his eyes. Like, it's so flippant for her. And that's like when someone knows you that well, that's what can happen. This movie does a very good job of elucidating that.
Yeah. The thing I like the most about the filmmaking in this movie is, I mean, it starts at the introduction, where we just get, throughout the opening credits, we get this couple walking home from this party together. And we see them walking down this long pathway together. They even walk past a part where there are sort of divergences, right? Like, it's sort of a four-way cross sort of thing in the path. And it's just sort of this visual representation of them continuing to walk this path together, more or less, you know?
Yeah.
And I found that an interesting shot. I thought that was... Immediately, I thought, oh, that's a nice way to show marriage. You know, like, even though there are other options, they continue to stay on the same path with each other. Yeah. Throughout the movie, we get a couple examples of, we get an example of George being without Martha and Martha being without George later on after they leave the bar, and Martha drives Honey and Nick back to Martha's place. We see George on his own. And then later, after Martha and Nick fail to have sex, it seems like Martha is just wandering alone through this yard, yelling, calling for George, you know?
Yeah.
And it's these two moments of them separate, and that's what they're really afraid of all throughout the movie, and that's why the end of the movie ends with them back together, and you know, tomorrow is just, it's just Sunday tomorrow, you know, theoretically we're back to normal, but we're too afraid of being alone, and that's why we won't let go of each other, you know. And I feel like that was a really subtle, really interesting thing, that the way they pulled it off, at least, you know.
Yeah,
because that is something that could be so hacky, you know, like very easily.
But we need each other.
Yeah, no. The fact that this movie ends with a shot of a couple holding hands, like an extreme close up, and I don't hate it. I think that's impressive.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, just gonna say something, forgot what it was.
Yeah.
Oops.
I'll just dance like the wind until you can figure it out. I'll do my probably, interpretive dance.
It was probably Crazy Billy, the Western Union Man. Fucking weird.
It was the 60s. Crazy Billy was what you called people that were good at their job.
People are named Crazy Billy.
Yeah.
What do you make of the title?
I think it's just, or at least the way we see it used throughout the movie, it's something to do to ignore the reality, right? It's when George is getting made fun of early in the house, with a scene that leads to Honey having to go vomit. He doesn't like the conversation that's going on, so he grabs Honey and starts singing a children's song, you know, with an adult modification to it. And yeah, I think it's just he didn't want to hear what was actually happening, so he tried to ignore it as best he could, and the best way he could ignore it was by singing louder than it. And yeah.
And that's the first use of it. Like, we hear it kind of a few times.
We hear it discussed before then.
Yeah,
she does it at the party, and she says it's a scream or whatever when yeah. when she's like sitting on his back in bed.
Yeah.
I love that scene.
Yeah, I know. That bedroom scene is really nice. I know I already said that, but I like it.
Yeah, it's very funny.
Yeah, and then later on, he kind of uses it to like insult Martha. Like this time, it's kind of used as like a shield. You know, as you said, she's about to reveal something that he doesn't want revealed. Pretty much everyone in this movie is kind of living a lot of lies. So this is just a way to prevent one from being revealed to Nick and Honey. Later, he kind of uses it to like kind of insult Martha a little bit mm-hmm. for her affair, and then. Eventually kind of to like near the end to kind of stop this lie. Like once all these lies have kind of been put out in the open, mm-hmm. There seems to be, I don't know, kind of this indication that, hey, now let's be honest.
Yeah.
But I have a feeling that's not going to stick too long.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, I think, one of the last things Martha says in this movie is that like, it's just us, you know, now that their fake son is dead.
Yeah.
they're worried about having just the two of them and being honest to each other, you know?
And, yeah. I mean, we were talking earlier about how it's kind of the lengths people go to not be alone and then, you know, to be like everyone else, to have somebody. And then, you know, that just goes further. They're like, oh, now that we're together, we need to be a family. And mm-hmm. they, you know, make up this fake kid and this whole story and everything. Yeah, but it's tons of lies going on in this movie, and then a lot of talk of like childhood versus parenthood. Like, there's mm-hmm. a lot of talk about kids and parents and things like that. Obviously, Nick and Honey have their discussion about their pregnancy and child.
Mm-hmm.
Martha and George have a very, you know, as we've discussed, their made-up kid and that whole story. Mm-hmm. But then we also have Martha's parents, or Martha's father, at least, who
yes.
plays a role.
Yeah.
And, Nick talks about Honey's parents and why that's kind of one of the reasons he probably married her, the money
mm-hmm.
and obviously the pregnancy as well, but kind of a reason they stay together, a reason it kind of works. And both of these couples are like, they talk about their children and wanting children, but they're still such children. Like, seriously though, like yeah. it's like all the games they play throughout, this childish song they sing, how irresponsible they are. They throw tantrums in public. You know, they have imaginary children. They have these kind of imaginary lives that, you know, Bert tells some story about his childhood that I don't think we're meant to see is completely true.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are, he also tells it as though it's not his life at one point. So there's really no way to read that. Right. Mm-hmm. And So when I, like, it's this dichotomy, like, these kids and these parents and these adults who aren't really, I don't think, nearly as adult as they think. And, you know, the alcoholism and just kind of generally being irresponsible and rude and just really, really childish. And I think that's the juxtaposition of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf, which is this kid song, which is also a kid song about, like, deception and being safe and like competition in a sense and things like that. A lot of the themes that get played out in this movie, interestingly enough. So we have this kind of young, cute, fun little childhood song, but then we plug in Virginia Woolf, which is not very childish at all. And I have, you know, to be honest, I haven't read any Virginia Woolf, but it's kind of another, kind of like Edward Albee, like another very dark person who kind of really looked for honesty and truth in human relationships. Mm-hmm. And even for people who do read a lot, I understand that Virginia Woolf is like a pretty hard, pretty difficult author to kind of fully understand and take in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's this combination of this, you know, cute, fun, cutesy childhood thing combined with these very, very dark adult themes. And, you know, that's kind of where this movie lives, is in this area of people not being who they think they are, not having lives that they thought they had, or not lives they thought they were going to have. So they make up these lies, and adults acting as children, and everything people are willing to do to not be alone.
Yeah, exactly. It really is this. I think this movie, more than anything else, is about just the fear of being alone. Like, you're willing to put up with all of this stuff just to know that there is somebody else with you, you know? And that is the main idea I think this movie wants us to get across, is that we're all just terrified of being alone.
Well, and I mean, we get what seems to be kind of a happy ending, at least in their terms. Like, they've decided to stop deceiving themselves and each other and other people, and want to stay together and want to be true and honest with each other, which I think is kind of the best we could really hope for out of a couple that's dysfunctional. But it's with the undertone of, well, that's probably not going to happen, but they have each other and they're still going to stay together.
Yeah, exactly. And the shot of the last wide shot of George turning off the last light in the room, you can see him sort of framed, like the camera slightly above him, I think, and sort of pointing down towards the desk where his where that paint, above which the painting hangs, in that living room. And as he's turning off the light, you sort of see, you can see a picture from their wedding day on that desk. And he just sort of turns out the light on that picture. It doesn't take up a lot of the frame at all, but it's very clearly there. And it's sort of like, it feels like a phase of their marriage is ending, you know? And this is what happens when people start being real, I guess, is the sequel to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, is them actually being honest with each other all the time and not playing games, you know?
We hope so, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it lasts a week, and then they have another kid.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And a pony.
Yeah. Or it turns out that the porcupine actually didn't exist, or the tree didn't actually exist, or Crazy Billy made it up as a goof.
What is the deal? Do you have a take on George's parents and that story about killing his mom and dad and porcupines?
No.
Okay.
No. I will say I did not put a lot of thought into it, and no, I do not. I'm certain there's something to be had. Do you have a reading of it?
No, I've not a reading of it. I just didn't know if you thought that was a real story or if that was like the kid completely fabricated, because he seems to let it slip one time that his parents took him to Greece after college or high school or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of gets glossed over, but it seems like his mom died when she was pretty young, or when he was pretty young. So I don't know. How are Nick and Honey going to be?
I don't know.
Same thing.
I think you could sort of look at it in two ways, right? You could sort of.
This was their warning, and now they know not to be like that.
Exactly. Like, you, you got to see what their discussions are like Sunday at breakfast. probably Sunday at dinner, which is probably the first time they might say a word to each other after this.
I think Honey's going to be nursing a pretty harsh hangover too.
Well, yeah. Although she gets it out earlier on. She might have a bit of a head start on Nick. Nick's just keeping it all in. I think it all depends on how they... If they make some sort of agreement, they're like, that was the weirdest thing that could ever possibly happen to us outside of being like abducted by aliens or something like that. Let's agree to never, ever discuss it. They could actually discuss it and try and sort of see if they can avoid having that happen to themselves, you know?
Yeah.
So I think I think the movie does leave it open, and for both couples, I think both couples are left in a state of flux, and yeah, you just kind of have to do some crazy make 'em ups to get the rest. You know?
In this movie, ends with a question mark, so you love it. Did you know Mike Nichols' first two movies got 20 Academy Award nominations?
No, but I mean, his first two movies were this and The Graduate, so.
This movie got nominated for every category it was eligible.
Okay.
One of two movies.
That's interesting.
And this was the last year for black and white cinematography as an award.
Mm-hmm. So, but it also got nominated for color cinematography because they're like, Haskell Wexler, you did it. You did it. You made black and white look color.
Like Nichols can do anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's kind of... like this movie does get a lot of love still. I think it's kind of fading a bit. I wonder if it's going to kind of last forever, but.
Well, I mean, like you saw it when Mike Nichols died. It was the graduate. Like,
exactly.
And I think justifiably so. As far as all of the Mike Nichols movies I've seen, it's definitely the top of the heap, but it's kind of like, when you do so much quality work, sometimes some of your quality work gets overshadowed by the true, like really great stuff that you made. And it's much easier to like The Graduate than it is to like this. They're both incredibly good movies. And I certainly like The Graduate more because I like The Graduate more than most elements of existence. it's something that just sort of happens that sometimes you're too good at your job to yeah. have all of your good contributions properly remembered.
Yeah, and I like this movie, but I mean, for future generations, Graduate's going to be about 1,000 times more accessible because it's got like color and music, and it's faster, and more stuff happens. And I mean, I also feel it's the better movie, but not nearly by as wide a margin as I think is going to be remembered.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, as long as Steven Soderbergh's still alive, there's going to be a handful of Mike Nichols movies that are well remembered because he will not stop talking about them. And I support that reflex.
Keep it up, soda pop.
Just one more important thing about this movie. Did you think Richard Burton looked a lot like Brian Doyle Murray?
I did not know who he looked like all movie. It was bugging me.
I think it's Brian Doyle Murray.
Oh, I had no idea. But I had seen Richard Burton before. So I was like, why is this starting to bug me now?
Yeah. It was weirding me out. And Honey looks so much like Alice Eve. Like it's
Alice Eve?
Yeah, she's the who is she? Who would you know her from? She's in X-Men First Class. She's in
Sex and City 2.
Yeah, exactly. She was in Star Trek Into Darkness as well. She's out of your league or whatever. They look so similar. But
I could see that.
Yeah.
I liked Honey though. She was all dippy and weird, but she was great.
Yeah, I thought throughout this movie, I thought all the performances were generally pretty good. Like, Honey was the most old-fashioned performance. Or, sorry, I guess, like, most consistently old-fashioned performance. Like, Liz Taylor obviously had some very old-fashioned moments just with her voice. Like, the bit? You know, like, all of those things were very, very old-fashioned. But I thought Richard Burton was great. And, you know, Nick was fine, you know?
Yeah. Well, just, this is one of...
And the gaffer and his wife were amazing.
I was just going to say, this is one of three movies that every credited actor was nominated for an award.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's really only six people in this movie, and there's really only four people in this movie.
Yeah. There are two extra people because they couldn't figure out how to do an empty bar scene, which was what for the first 5 minutes of that scene. I'm like, how are they doing a scene with just four people in a bar? Like,
I know. I was like,
this place has to still be open, right? They didn't break in.
Yeah, that confused me for a bit.
Yeah, and, she can dance like the wind. I know that, but can she break into places like the wind?
So Edward Albee, I guess some producer hired himself to write this movie, to do the adaptation, and then it ended up being apparently terrible. Like, everyone involved thought the new script was awful, and so this movie is a pretty faithful adaptation of the play, is my understanding.
Yeah, that's what I got out of research as well.
Yeah, and the only real difference is that the whole thing takes place in Martha and George's house, so the trip to the bar and back isn't there. And so that producer hired himself for $250,000 to write this, and then they ended up changing everything back except the lines, like, let's go to the roadhouse and let's leave the roadhouse. So Edward Albee thought $125,000 per word isn't bad for rewriting a movie.
That's funny. So thank you for listening to The Guffman. Be sure to check back next week when we will be talking about another film that we have yet to decide upon. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter, and you can get links to this episode and then also future links to other episodes. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.